going to read from several passages from the Gospel of Luke, which has a different take on some of these things than like the Gospel of Matthew or Mark or John, as each perspective is given. We oftentimes, at least those from the Christian tradition, tend to think that, well, there's one story, but if you compare the accounts in the different Gospels, it also comes to a little bit different understanding. So that in the first story that we have is the birth story, and you won't see wise men in this particular version, but you will find shepherds, not in the part that I'm going to read, but in Luke's Gospel. But I did want to read at least the announcement to Mary from the angel. In the Gospel of Matthew, we have not the announcement to Mary, but to actually her fiancé, Joseph. So in this case, we've got Mary. So the first chapter, verses 26 through 38. Hear these words. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth, to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph, in the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary, and he came to her and said, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was much perplexed by his words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be great, and he will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give to him the throne of his ancestor David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom there will be no end." Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I am a virgin?" The angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore the child to be born will be holy. He will be called Son of God. And now your relative Elizabeth in her old age has also conceived a son, and this is the sixth month for her who was said to be barren. For nothing will be impossible with God." Then Mary said, "Here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Then the angel departed from her. And now, as if that wasn't miracle enough, I'm going to give you a second and a third one to go. The next is probably a familiar story. You may have heard of the feeding of the 5,000, and this particular rendition is found in chapter 9 of Luke, verses 12 through 17. The day was drawing to a close, and the 12 came to Jesus and said, "Send the crowd away so that they may go into the surrounding villages and countryside to lodge and get provisions, for we are here in a deserted place." But he said to them, "You give them something to eat." They said, "We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we are to go and buy food for all these people." For there were about 5,000 men. And that did not include all the women and children, by the way. And he said to his disciples, "Make them sit down in groups of about 50 each." They did so and made them all sit down. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke them and gave them to the disciples to set before the crowd. And all ate and were filled. What was left over was gathered up, 12 baskets of broken pieces. Wow. And now for the climactic miracle that I'm going to talk about today, resurrection. Okay, and this one comes from, this version of it comes from the 24th chapter of Luke, verses 1 through 49. So a little bit long passage here, so bear with me. But try to listen for what is being said in this passage. "But on the first day of the week at early dawn, they came to the tomb of Jesus. Taking the spices they had prepared, they found the stone rolled away from the tomb, and when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly 2 men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. The women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, 'Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he told you while he was in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified, and on the third day rise again?' Then they remembered his words, and returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women with them who told this to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. But Peter got up and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves. Then he went home, amazed at what had happened. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. And while they were talking and having discussions, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a mighty prophet in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some of the women in our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. And as they came near to a village in which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it's almost evening and the day is now over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was there at table with them, he took bread, blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, 'The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what happened on the road and how he had made known to them in the breaking of bread. And while they were talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, 'Peace be with you.' They were startled and terrified and thought that they were seeing a ghost. He said to them, 'Why are you frightened? Why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet. See that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones as I have.' And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. While in their joy they were disbelieving and still wondering, he said to them, 'Have you anything to eat here?' They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence," something a ghost wouldn't do. "Then he said to them, 'These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled.' Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, 'Thus it is written that the Messiah is to suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins is to be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And see, I am sending upon you what my Father promised. So stay here in the city until you have been clothed with power on high." Whoa. All right. So we have these scriptures here, and they're quite familiar to those who are from the Christian tradition as three of the great miracles in the New Testament. But speaking to a group of UUs, or people who most likely see themselves as progressives, maybe spiritual, not religious, why would I want to talk about miracles to this group? Well, if we speak about miracles, one, when we think of miracles, are we really having to adopt the view of those who would say This is what miracles are. Can miracles be for us something different than what maybe we've been told in our past? Can they be something significant in a different way that doesn't have to be supernatural? Just some food for thought. Why would I want to speak on something that is religious if most of us consider us spiritual but not religious? And here I do have a little bit of an agenda. The agenda is that I think all of us can be spiritual. Any one of us. And we can be spiritual all by ourselves. But as I look out on you, you are gathered not by yourselves, but you're here in community. I don't know what your view of religious is, but mine is that religion is the place where we meet together in community to discuss our spiritual lives. It's where we share our spirits with one another. That may not be your definition of what religion is, but kind of take it as mine for the purpose of this sermon. It'll make it a lot easier, I think, to say, okay, that I can see that we're all together here and we're religious because we're a part of a community. We can tend to not give, oftentimes, people the benefit of the doubt if we hear that they're religious. As a pastor who is of a Christian denomination, I do that myself all the time. If somebody tells me, well, are you saved? Immediately, I stereotype them as being a certain kind of people who I'm probably not going to agree with on a lot of things, theologically speaking. But if I get in conversation with them, I can explain to them how that word may mean something a little different to me. My perception of it is a little different than maybe what theirs is. And as we talk about that, sometimes we see some commonalities that we didn't see before. So why speak on religious truth rather than on spiritual truth for a group of progressives? Maybe to create more understanding and help us to be more patient and tolerant of those around us. Maybe that we can learn truths about others that we wouldn't have seen before if we got to know them a little better. There was a professor that I had when I was in undergraduate school. And beyond philosophy, I also had religious studies as my two majors that I had. But philosophy became really important in my life. And I took a class on logic, and I learned all these techniques for how to dissect arguments and such. And I did just the most wonderful paper you'd ever read on this guy that is a theologian. And I just dissected his argument almost in every place. And I thought I was doing so well. And I got reprimanded by my professor, who said, you've done a wonderful logical analysis of this argument, but you haven't given him the benefit of the doubt. You haven't tried to understand where he's coming from. Rather, you have given him the weakest position rather than the strongest position. And if you're going to have integrity as a biblical scholar or as a theologian, you need to give the strongest position to your opponents so as to best understand them, and therefore be able to define your own position as different from that. It's a good lesson for me in humility of how to not look at what I can do to somebody else's argument and saying that this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, but to try to understand them better and to learn more about my own views as a result of having honestly and earnestly tried to understand theirs. Religion, by the way, another reason why I would say I should speak on religion today is because religion in its root terms means to bind together. And isn't that what we all want as humanity, to bind ourselves together for one another? So if you can't think of it in the community mind, think of it as a binding together. It's kind of communitarian in itself. So those are some of the reasons why I'm going to speak about miracles in a different way than what you may have heard them. Many religious people believe in miracles. And as we think about miracles ourselves, we say, well, you know, I really don't believe in miracles. I believe in natural phenomena. I believe in things that can be explained by science that you can verify or falsify with proof, experiments. And I'm with you to a degree. But then I recognize that much of life is stuff that we can't prove. I can no more prove to you that God does or does not exist than I can prove that love exists. You can say that you experience it, and I'll say yes, and I do too. But if I had to give you an experiment of how to prove it, I would have nothing. There is so much about life, and especially the most important part of life, in my estimation, about the meanings, the value, the purpose of what our life is, that science will never be able to answer. And so that may be a good reason to talk about religious truth today. Not from a scientific perspective, but one from what I would call a mythopoetic perspective. Or maybe to use different terms, instead of looking at it in a literal sense, the scriptures, look at them metaphorically or figuratively. Miracles, therefore, would not be considered, as many might tell us, that they are historical, supernatural, and factual events, but that they are experiences that significantly shape our worldview or perception on reality, so as to provide us with more meaning, with more purpose, with more fulfillment in life. Can you agree to that? As a person who considers themselves more UU than I do even my own denomination of the UCC, this is what miracles mean to me. There's something in which create that meaning, that purpose, that substance of life, that give it a sense of fulfillment that if I didn't believe in miracles at all, or if I only believed in what I could factually prove, I would feel pretty empty in my life. The truth of miracles is not whether or not they happened, but rather what meaning they have to our lives. It's about whether they can positively transform our perceptions of our lives and the lives of others in our world. And so a natural event that happens at the right time in our lives, giving us meaning or purpose or value, those may be considered miracles if we are open to the transformation that can happen through that experience. So it's not about whether things exist out there, whether it be God, or whether it be these miracle stories, whether they actually happened or not. It's what meaning that we apply from these stories. I've been told many a good fable, and I thought, isn't that a wonderful story about life? Not to say that all the Bible should be read as a fable, but if we look at it metaphorically or mythopoetically, we might be able to open ourselves to seeing it in a different perspective rather than just one, namely a literal one. And why should we allow fundamentalists or anybody tell us this is what is true, this is what it means? Are we not UUs who want to think for ourselves and to be able to interpret things in new ways? I ask you to ponder that. Another reason that I think it is important for us as progressives to reclaim religious truth rather than just spiritual truth is that we do need to say there is another way of looking at this that isn't depicted in our culture as a whole. I have had many friends who have talked to me, and at first they may have not known that I was a minister. And they would get to know me and think, oh, well, okay, you're a pretty good guy, you know. You have a broad view of understanding. You look at things in a lot of the ways that I would. And then they find I'm a pastor and say, you just kind of blow away my impressions of what a pastor is and what a pastor believes. And I say, why is that? Because we can all choose to think about things as we will. We're all able to open up our minds to different understandings than what may be perceived out there. And one of the things I think that, especially as a person who calls himself Christian, I get a little disgruntled, admittedly, about those who depict, not being Christians themselves, but to depict Christians as being all fundamentalists. There needs to be a different perspective out there, and a progressive perspective is one which I hold, and one which I think all of you probably hold as well. We need to get the word out that spiritual growth is possible for us too, that we can learn from scriptures in ways in which we can reinterpret, maybe even reimagine them differently than they have been for us in the past. It engages our sense of awe and also our sense of creativity to look at Scripture, whether it be Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, or whether it be Muslim or any religious tradition, to look at it in a way that can have a multiplicity of meanings rather than just one. If we let somebody else tell us this is what it means, we give up the opportunity to let ourselves find meaning in those passages. Now, maybe we don't want to let them find meaning, but I think oftentimes we can. When we look at these three miracles, the first being the virgin birth, we look at these and we say, what meaning does this have for us today? As scientifically minded people, virgin birth just doesn't make sense. I remember when I first learned that the word in Greek for virgin is Parthenon, which doesn't simply mean virgin, but means young woman. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's a virgin, but just could be a young woman. I thought, oh, there's my scapegoat right there. I can now believe that she was a young woman. But even if she were a virgin, I look at it now and saying, maybe it wasn't true, historically speaking, but isn't it a neat story? And what is this actually telling to my life now? Is it not telling me, if I'm a progressive, that the divine can enter our lives in ways that we thought were unimaginable? That which is sacred can infiltrate our lives in ways that seem miraculous? Isn't that a different way of understanding, but yet a kind of a neat way? How many believes that you've experienced the sacred or divine in your lives in some way? Got quite a few people who would agree with that. I would guess that quite a few of you saying that that wasn't just God doing that to you, that it was something that you felt deep within. Maybe that's what this story is about from a progressive perspective. That we can see this story about the possibility of the divine, the sacred, entering our lives, living among us, even living within us. Or perhaps we can look at it in a different way, mythopoetically, rather than the literal way which said that, well, this is proof that Jesus was divine. This is proof that he was God's son. This is proof that God became incarnate among us, to live among us, to be the expiation for our sins. That's the literal or traditional way of looking at it. But I can think of at least a few other mythopoetic ways of looking at it. It could be that the sacred divine can be born in all of us. Not just Jesus, but in all of us. That the immanence of God can be in us, just as it was in Jesus. We could look at it in yet a third way, that we can take a virgin to mean a new, an innocent, a pure, or an awed approach to understanding our lives and the lives of others. After Christmas time comes Epiphany in the Christian year. And Epiphany means that you have kind of a revelation that something is you see it in a different perspective than you ever saw it before. Could this not be an epiphany for us that when we think of the virgin birth, that virginity, that pureness, that newness can be born into us, that we can look at things in a way that we've never looked at them before? Yet another way of describing this virgin birth is how our relationship with the divine, whether we name that God or any other name, can be affirmed and nurtured in our lives. And also in our relationships. I have experienced many times going out in nature and walking along, and I get my most spiritual moments at those times. And yet, sometimes when I'm in a community of people like yourselves, and we talk about things with each other, and I hear a different perspective, or maybe the same perspective of mine, said just in a different way, I feel a sense of connection that really makes me feel there is something sacred going on here. And that's a really good feeling to have. Now, if we take the virgin birth in those ways, that doesn't have to be a literal event, but it could be a figurative, imaginative event, then could we not look at the feeding of the 5,000 in a similar way? The literal or traditional view is that this proves that, again, Jesus was divine by nature, that he either was God himself or had God working through him, because he was able to do this supernatural thing of multiplying the food. Now, if you look closely in the text, whether it be Luke, Matthew, or Mark, either one, it doesn't actually say that he supernaturally multiplied the food. The explanation is up for your imagination. But this is what we've often been taught, that this is the way it happened, that it just got multiplied, that he did it miraculously, even though it doesn't say it in any of the texts of the Gospels. I would venture a different suggestion that I think is even more miraculous than that a person multiplied, one person multiplied food. And the interpretation I take from this is that whichever account you look at, what is being taught is not how wonderful and divine Jesus is, but how wonderful and divine generosity is. If you have a group of 5,000 men, which probably is only a quarter of all the people, women and children that are gathered around, and you're out in a deserted place, you got 20,000 people here, and you have 5 loaves of bread and a few fish, and you hold them up in the air and say, I'm going to share this with all of you. People are going to think, what? How's that going to happen? Let me ask you a question. If you were going out into a wilderness area, would you take food along with you or not? And wouldn't you have it probably in a pack? So if you saw somebody who was generous and was willing to share what little they had with you, would it not inspire a generosity in you to share what you have in your pack with everybody else? Could that not be the reason they had 12 basketfuls left after the event? I'm not saying that is what happened, but I think it's kind of a neat way of looking at it that for me is even more miraculous. Is it more miraculous that somebody's able to do magical events? Or is it more miraculous that you can change the hearts of thousands of people, 20,000 people, to stop being selfish and to be generous? I'll vote for the miracle of the latter over the former any day of the week. Different way of looking at it? Yeah. But kind of fun, isn't it? We don't have to let somebody else tell us what these things mean. We can think for ourselves as you use. The last event is that of the resurrection. Now, this is where you go from preaching to meddling. The resurrection is a view in which has been a part of the Christian faith for so long. And yet, many Christians really don't understand this view themselves. Because resurrection is not the same thing as resuscitation. We've heard of resuscitation on the operating table where somebody was flatlined and then they come back to life. That's resuscitation. Resurrection is a whole different phenomena. It's not a physical phenomena so much as it is a spiritual phenomena, a transformation of one's spirit, so that you become a different person. Why do you think they couldn't recognize Jesus in that story that I gave earlier? He was with them. He walked with them for miles and then ate dinner with them. And they didn't recognize him the whole time until finally he broke bread with them and said a few words and they got it. And the question is, did that even happen factually? And if you ask me whether that happened factually or not, I say, as a Christian pastor, it doesn't make a lot of difference to me whether it happened or not. But what does matter to me is what relevance that has to my life, and whether I can believe in resurrection as something happening not just to Jesus, but to me and to you and to all people in the world. If it makes a difference in our lives, gives us meaning or purpose or value or worth, gives us a sense of fulfillment in our lives, isn't that what is most important? our perceptions of reality can change as we adopt a resurrection mentality of life. That it is not about Jesus the person, but Jesus' way of love, of peace, of compassion, of understanding, of patience with one another. That is the real testimony of the resurrection of spirit within each of us. If we don't look at it as being about the person, but rather his value system, his way of life, his virtues, can it not be true that Jesus' words when he said, "You will even do greater things than me," that he actually meant that? Because you can share that same spirit. You can have love abide in you, peace, tenderness, gentleness. All the things that we most revere and honor as you use as well as Christians. And so, if we ask ourselves how this understanding helps us to look at life, I would offer these suggestions. One, if we don't become literal and we look at things a little bit more metaphorically, it may make us more open-minded in understanding people and their perspectives. It may also help us to share of our own spiritual journeys and thoughts with those who we don't think agree with us, because it's not about who's right or who's wrong. It's about sharing truths with each other. It may also help us to get out of our scientific worldviews and to ask about the meaning, purpose, and fulfillment of our lives rather than just what we can know factually. And lastly, it can tell us to be wiser and more compassionate in our view of life and others, and give us a greater respectfulness that we show for others. And hopefully that will have a ripple effect in helping them to do the same. And so with all this in mind, I invite you to let the sacred, the divine, enter into your lives, and may it dwell among you, not only in this season, but in all seasons. Blessed be.